But the system buzzed again, and the same message broadcast across the screen. Lance Corporal Haywalt stepped into the office with a toothbrush in his mouth. "Did I hear the..." He leaned forward and read the screen. "Holy shit. Is that for real?" Then he noticed Sykes with his head between his legs. "What are you doing down there, Corporal?" Sykes sat up so fast he saw stars. He managed to clear his throat. "Adjusting my boots," he said, his voice a little more high-pitched than he'd wanted. He deepened it and added, "Get first squad together for response. I want them ready to deploy in 5 minutes." Haywald stared at Sykes as if he'd just spoken Chinese. Sykes shook his head and stood as he shouted, "Move, Lance Corporal!" That broke the spell, and a second later, Haywald hit the alert button. Sykes did a complete security sweep of the system. They hadn't had any visitors since a ship full of Weyland-Yutani medtechs had come to vaccinate the miners with a new strain of penicillin. Of the 742 miners, 217 were on shift. Sykes sent a message to the Weyland-Yutani site manager, ordering him to hold off sending in the next shift. Sykes got an immediate, terse reply. "No can't do." Sykes typed furiously, "Your miners are sending an SOS. I'm sure it's nothing." There it was. His out. If the Weyland-Yutani corporate site lead didn't want Colonial Marine support, who was Sykes to shove it down his throat? Everything was suddenly right with the world. Sykes brushed his hands together, then typed a message. "Colonial Marines, Weyland-Yutani declines assistance. Stand down." Then he pressed send and turned off the alert. He put his feet on the desk and grinned, relishing the silence. Now he'd definitely have time to finalize the trap for the consortium. Who in the hell did they think they were messing with anyway? His thoughts burrowed into the virtual reality of Charity Rock as he planned his Machiavellian machinations. Not for the first time, or even the 100th, did he wish the realities were reversed, and the game he played as an intergalactic trader was being a Colonial Marine. He was hungry, too. Wasn't it time for breakfast? Sykes found himself in the galley, drinking the last of his coffee, when Lance Corporal Haywald ran in wearing full battle rattle, an M41A pulse rifle, M3 pattern personal armor, black fatigues with knee, elbow, shin, and forearm ballistic pads, and a ballistic helmet with a riot mask that served to both protect the face and be a visual locus for the heads-up display, or HUD. Sykes felt a slash of pain go through his head as a headache was born and died. "What is it, Lance Corporal?" he asked. Breakfast lay like a brick road across his gut. Haywald hesitated before he answered, then said, "Weyland-Yutani site lead has requested our assistance." He changed his mind. "He can't change his mind," Sykes pounded the table. "He said they didn't want any assistance," he said, realizing his voice had again risen too high. "Apparently he did," Haywald said. Sykes put his head in his hand and shook it back and forth slowly, saying, "No," over and over again like it would be the magic word to change reality. Haywald shifted from his right foot to his left. Corporal?
What, Haywald?
Me and the others are gonna go take care of this. You can take it easy if you want. Sykes stopped shaking his head and stared coldly at his subordinate. Haywald held out his hand. He flashed a false grin.
"Really, sir? We got this?"
It was one thing to be a coward, but it was another to be treated like one. Sykes fought the urge to accept Haywald's offer. Yeah, he could sit back and let his subordinates take care of things. After all, he was the ranking Marine. Who was he to put himself in harm's way? But there was something in Haywald's eyes that made him balk. Sykes couldn't put a finger on it, but it was almost like the younger Haywald felt sorry for him. And that Sykes couldn't stand. Sykes pushed himself to his feet.
"Are the others ready?"
"First squad is, Corporal,"
Haywald answered.
"Have second and third squad stand by. Let first know I'll be with them in 10 minutes.
Haywald started to walk away. Lance Corporal. Haywald turned.
Sir?
Never presume to know what the corporal thinks or wants. Understood?
Understood, Corporal.
Dismissed. As soon as Haywald left the room, Sykes's entire body sagged, and he threw himself back onto the bench. This was it. He was doomed. He died 1,000 times over the next 30 seconds, inventing new ways to be broken, shot, eaten, melted, burned, gassed, crushed, and cut open. Not knowing what the monster looked like, his panicked brain invented an entire mental zoo filled with various and sundry terrible creatures, each one making him flinch, the realities of his own imagination too scary for him to behold. He stood unsteadily and took two steps, then the contents of his stomach spewed onto the floor. 30 minutes later, they were on the lift to the lower levels. During the trip, Sykes was remotely notified through his helmet's communication suite that 3 of the 7 members of the Charity Rock Trade Consortium, who'd allied against him, had found his back door. He groaned. Without him to spring the trap, they'd have unfettered access to his accumulated wealth. They arrived at Tunnel 10, which had been drilled, mined, and smoothed decades before, and was now used for administration and logistics functions. In fact, all the single-digit tunnels were the same way. If the danger was some sort of monster, he'd expect it to come from one of the lower tunnels, possibly towards the bottom of the mine, which would make it Tunnel 91. A 4th member of the consortium entered through his back door. Sykes gritted his teeth. First squad was comprised of Haywald, Mykia, Chevalon, Franks, Phillips, Shire, and Albright. Mykia had seen the most action, but he couldn't keep his drinking under control, so he remained a perennial PFC. Albright and Shire were converted criminals, and were solid, if not inexperienced, PFCs. Chevalon was so wet behind her ears she could barely put her gear on. That left Phillips and Haywald, both solid Lance Corporal Marines, and the 2 he could most count on. Shire. She popped forward, ready, her face scarred from ritualistic tattooing on a prison barge.
Yes, Corporal.
You and Phillips head down the hall and recon. Go 100 meters, then hunker down and report. Phillips nodded and joined Shire. Together they moved in a tactical crouch down the hall and around the curve. They reported in at 50 meters. 3 minutes later, gunfire from 2 pulse rifles rocketed the tunnel.
Shire! Phillips, report!
Sykes called through his helmet. No response.
Corporal, what should we do?
Chevalon asked, sweat beating across her nose and above her upper lip. She wiped it away with a quick hand.
We wait. Those Marines know what they're doing.
At least Sykes hoped they were okay.
An image of 100 multi-limbed monsters tearing around the corner towards them forced him to close his eyes for a few seconds. Just then he received electronic notification that the 5th and 6th members of the consortium had found his back door. Maybe if he was able to get this over quickly, he could get back into Charity Rock and spring his trap. He reluctantly opened his eyes. As it stood, right now he was helpless to do anything about the damn consortium. If they worked together, they could strip him of all the wealth he'd accumulated in 17,000 hours of gameplay. How many night shifts would he have to pull just to get a portion of it back? Albright and Franks shifted nervously. Chevalon almost dropped her rifle, and would have if it hadn't been for the sling. Sykes hissed into his helmet.
Shire! Come in, Shire!
He hated being blind. He hated not knowing what was going on.
Phillips, report!
He hated being down here instead of back in his hooch. He hated that the universe had decided today would be the day it fucked with him. He basically hated every damned thing. 10, 20, 30 seconds ticked by as he continued his inventory of hate, his index finger tapping impatiently at the trigger well.
"What's going on, Corporal?"
Haywald asked. Sykes shook his head. How was he supposed to know? Why should he know anything? After all, he was only the one in charge.
A blood-curdling scream was abruptly silenced from somewhere far down the tunnel. His anger faltered as fear tickled the back of his neck. He thought this was the worst situation he'd ever been in. He forced himself to breathe normally. "Shire, Phillips, this is Command One. Come in," he said again into his helmet. Static. Then Haywald pointed down the hall. "There... what's that?" Sykes raised his pulse rifle and sighted down its length. He'd never fired one outside of training. Would now be the moment? A shock of electric dread sizzled through him. He tasted metal. His entire body felt hollow as he moved his finger to the trigger. A dark figure slumped from one side of the tunnel to the other, moving too fast for them to ascertain its features. As much as Sykes wanted to understand what he was seeing, the constant motion and the sweat dribbling into his eyes made it impossible. "What is it?" he asked, his finger tightening on the trigger. "It's moving too fast," Haywald cried. "Shoot it, Corporal!" Sykes wanted to wipe the sweat from his eyes, but to do so would mean he'd lose his sight picture. He blinked furiously, then in one crystalline moment, he saw what he was aiming at. He lowered his weapon and stepped forward. PFC Shire's impossibly fast gyration slowed as she stumbled the last dozen feet, then fell to the ground, her arms and legs spasming out of control. Her eyes were wide and panicked behind a scratched faceplate. "Spitting," she managed to say. "Spitting," she repeated. "Spitting what?" Sykes noticed a fine spray of liquid on the outside of her helmet. There was no sign of her weapon.
Everyone... spitting.
Why would anyone be spitting? It made no sense. And Phillips, where was he? Shire's entire body went rigid, then stilled. Her eyes were shut. Where her chest had been furiously heaving a second before, it now moved only slightly.
"What happened to her?"
Haywald asked. "No idea." Sykes turned to his men and said, "Keep sharp. Something got Shire and maybe Phillips. We still don't know what it is." Fear shined on five young faces. Haywald, Mykia, Chevalon, Franks, and Albright. All staring at Corporal Sykes, waiting for him to lead them. He stared back, realizing how invested they were in him. His remote indicated that the seventh member of the consortium had made it through his back door. He dismissed the information packet. He didn't have time for any charity rock bullshit now. For perhaps the first time in his life, Sykes felt ready to lead. The hollow bowl with him was now filled with a confidence he'd never before felt. The looks his Marines gave him had power, and had given him the wherewithal to act like the Marine he was always supposed to have been. Sykes had spent his life running from danger only to have danger find him. And now that he was confronted with it, he found that he liked the feeling it gave him. The adrenaline rush made him focus, noticing things, thinking critically in an instant. He'd leave Shire behind. She was still alive. They'd get her to sick bay when they returned. In the meantime, they had to find Phillips and ascertain what the threat was. He grinned. "Listen, Marines. Stay behind me, follow my commands, and we'll get through this. Someone or something is on the station, and we need to find it." He cleared his throat. "Even more important, we need to find Phillips." All the Marines nodded. Chevalon looked absolutely terrified. Sykes grabbed her shoulder. "Come on, Marine. If you die, at least you'll die a hero." She nodded and wiped sweat from her brow with her sleeve, her fear coalescing into something else, something nearer determination. The scientists, miners, and Marines all counted on him, and for the first time it didn't feel like a burden. No, the feeling of responsibility and of service warmed him from within.
"What about Shire?"
Franks asked. "Leave her. We'll get her to the sick bay when this is all over. Now follow me." Sykes moved forward in a tactical crouch. He held his rifle at low ready, the way Marines had been holding their rifles since before Hamarana, before the Kincaid, before Mogadishu, and before Tarawa. Muzzled down, stock firmly in the shoulder,
A Marine could bring his weapon to bear in a moment's notice while still able to assess and see what was in front of him. 30 meters down the corridor, a miner lay in a pool of blood. This must have been who Shire had shot, but why? There seemed to be nothing out of place. The miner wore his protective boots, jumpsuit, and gloves. Other than a missing helmet, unnecessary in this section of tunnels, everything was as it should be. Except, of course, the gaping hole in the center of the man's chest. Whatever had happened, Shire had assessed and believed there to be a threat. That Sykes couldn't immediately recognize what the threat had been didn't matter. He was confident he soon would. A composite metal door stood another 15 meters down the tunnel on the left. Sykes stacked my Kia and Chevalon on one side and put Franks and Albright on the other. He had Haywald form behind him. He called up the map of this level on his HUD. Meeting room 57 was on the other side, with another door on the far side leading to a tunnel that gave access to the other side of the complex. The door in front of him was currently locked. Sykes unlocked it using his HUD. "Open the door, Haywald." The young Marine gave him a worried glance, but did as he was told. When the door opened, Sykes leaned inside to look. Across a room with overturned tables and chairs, 6 miners had trapped a 7th who was huddled in a corner, his hands covering his face, screaming for them to stop. Instead of punching or kicking the 7th man, the others were bent at the waist, spitting at him. They looked more like giant birds violently pecking at the air, but even from across the room, Sykes could see the spittle flying from their mouths, coating the man's hands, dripping onto his chest, creating a thick, viscous puddle. Sykes raised his rifle and fired into the other corner of the room. "Stand down," he shouted. All 6 of the attackers spun toward him. Sykes felt an eerie sense of the weird as he saw the expressions on their faces. He'd expected anger, possibly even rage. Why else would they have decided to spit on one of their own? Instead, they seemed entirely void of emotion. Their faces were slack, their eyes were empty. Then they began to run at him. Sykes brought his rifle up, but thought better of it and stepped back into the hallway. "Close the door." Haywald slammed it shut. Sykes locked the door via his HUD and threw his back against it. What the hell had just happened? He replayed it in his mind. 6 miners had cornered a 7th and were spitting on him. When they'd heard Sykes, they'd turned and run at him as if to attack, despite the fact they were facing a Marine wearing full body armor and carrying a pulse rifle. That made no sense. What was driving them so mad?
"Corporal Sykes, look here," Chevalon said, pointing to a stain on the wall about 10 meters down the hall.
Haywald ran towards the spot.
"It's blood, Corporal."
"Maybe it's Phillips's," Albright said.
Sykes pushed himself away from the door and led the others to the stain. It had the vague outlines of a bloody handprint.
"Makia, anything from Phillips?"
He shook his head.
"Keep at it."
When he didn't acknowledge, Sykes turned. He and Albright were off to the side whispering to each other, Makia shaking his head.
"You two, what's going on?"
Albright straightened. Makia sneered and shook his head again.
"What is it?"
Sykes demanded.
"Albright has a theory," Makia began, "but I think he's been watching too many discs."
"What is it?"
Sykes was losing his patience.
"Albright, speak up!"
Albright glanced worriedly at Makia, who looked away.
"I've been thinking," he began, then faltered.
"You know, the only thing scarier than a Marine saying, 'I've been thinking,' is a miner saying, 'Watch what I built,'" Sykes said.
"I told you so," Makia said.
Albright's shoulders slumped and he stared at the ground. Sykes nodded.
"Still, I've got the smartest Marines in 100 parsecs, so tell me."
"We're the only Marines in 100 parsecs, Albright said.
"Yep, you made the cut," Sykes said.
"Now out with it." Before he could speak, 3 miners appeared from far down the tunnel, running at them at full speed. Their heads moved like they were pecking air, but Sykes knew they were spitting. Everyone raised their weapons.
"What do we do?"
Chevalon asked.
"Shoot them," he said.
All of them opened up on the charging men who were hurled backwards by the combined force of their pulse rifle rounds. After a moment, Sykes said, "Watch out for more." Then to Albright, he said, "Where were we?"
"I was trying to figure out what's going on when I remembered something that happened on the prison barge. I was in solitary at the time, but the survivors talked about experimentation."
"Experimentation?"
"Medtechs came in and gave everyone shots, and 2 hours later, there was a riot."
"Did they spit?"
"No, nothing like that. The other inmates, they just became enraged and tried to kill each other."
"And they blamed it on the medtechs?"
Albright shrugged. "Nothing definite, but everyone was fine, then everyone got shots, then everyone wasn't fine."
He squinted his eyes.
"We were... what do you call it? A hostage population?" said Haywald.
"Like the miners," said Sykes.
"Like the miners," Albright said,
"who were just visited by Weyland-Yutani medtechs."
Sykes saw it all now. An old, played-out mine. Too many miners to move. Why not test out a new bioweapon? And the spitting... was that the delivery mechanism? Damn.
"What do we do?"
Chevalon asked.
"We find Phillips and get the hell out of here."
Saying those words inspired him. The old Sykes would have said it was a good reason to leave, using the situation as a valid reason to save his own ass. But now... in the face of danger, he was able to make command decisions just as he was supposed to. To say he was filled with pride was an understatement. He'd gone from being an utter zero to something near a hero. Was this what it felt like? He damned his old self and felt a wash of shame slam over him, but then it was gone as he began to plan. He needed to get Phillips, then grab Shire and get them to sickbay. Once there, they would secure the mine and send a message for rescue. He and his Marines could probably hold out for 6 to 10 months, which was enough time for a ship to rescue them. As for the miners, if what Albright said was correct, it was their own corporation that had done them in. Sykes would make sure and report them as soon as he returned to known space. To do so earlier might put the lives of his Marines in jeopardy. Damn. But his mind was clicking like a computer.
Corporal?
Asked Chevalon.
Are you hearing what I'm hearing?
Sykes spun, a self-satisfied smile almost breaking his face.
What?
All of his Marines had turned to face down the tunnel. Sykes cocked his head. He could just hear something that sounded like faraway rushing water, except it was getting closer. His eyes narrowed. Rushing water? On this moon? The sound grew louder, a low rush accentuated with what could only be waves. He checked his HUD for air quality to make sure they weren't hallucinating, reacting to something in the air. No, the air was the same thin mixture of oxygen and other chemicals to which they'd long ago become accustomed. Sykes had no idea what was coming.
"Weapons ready, Marines," he whispered.
As one, they brought their pulse rifles to bear, stocks snug against their shoulders. Tickle of fear teased his stomach. Was this what it was like to lead? Were leaders scared as well? For so long he'd always thought that those who stood in the face of danger were fearless. He inhaled to steady his nerves, then laughed again, which made several of the Marines turn and eye him. He nodded to each of them.
"Steady," he said, low and mean.
Then the first of them appeared. It wasn't water. There were no waves. It was the miners, shuffling their feet against the tunnel floor, moving only inches at a time. The combined sound of hundreds of feet, constantly shuffling, had confused his brain, making it think the sound came from water. How could it know that instead of walking, several hundred miners would be shuffling like they were 100 years old and could barely move? More and more they came. An immense clump of shuffling miners moving along the long curve of the tunnel. Their heads were down, chins resting against their chests. He couldn't see if their eyes were open.
"Do we shoot them?"
Makia asked. The sound of the Marine's voice triggered a change. The miners ceased all movement. Then, in one eerie, pendulous move, their heads swiveled upwards. Blank gazes focused on them. There were too many. Calculations clicked through Sykes's mind. He had to try something else. Marines, to me. We're going to move back. He began to back away. His Marines joined him. Then the miners broke into a run. Oh, hell! Sykes turned and ran. To me! He ran back to the door they'd locked. It was their only chance. He unlocked it and swung it open. 7 miners stood inside, staring at the open space where the door had been closed. Sykes wasn't sure if they were surprised. It didn't matter. He fired his pulse rifle from the hip, mowing them down as he pushed into the room, stepping over their freshly fallen bodies. Then he ran to the back of the room and took up position. Gunfire erupted from the tunnel. Haywald and Mykia stumbled into the room. Chevalon came next, firing and screaming, her face bloody, her left arm hanging dead.
"Shut the door!" she cried. "They've got the others!"
Haywald shoved his shoulder against it and Mykia joined him. When it latched, Sykes locked it. Albright and Franks hadn't made it. That made 4 Marines Sykes had lost, if you included Shire and Phillips. Sykes put a fist to the side of his head and held it there. Shire. He'd left her out in the tunnel. And Phillips, where was he? Haywald and Mykia came to him.
What are your orders, Corporal?
Haywald asked. Sykes looked at each of them. What were his orders?
Your orders?
Haywald repeated. Sykes cleared his throat.
You and Mykia see to Chevalon. Make sure she's okay, then post a sentry by the door.
They looked at each other, then obeyed. Sykes was struck by the simplicity of it all. The mine was as much a trap for the miners as his game had been for the consortium. Each was a perfect setup. The only difference was that the game was just that, a game. Had he been thinking about the real live posting on LV-666 as he had the game, he might have been able to anticipate that a place so remote and played out might be an experiment waiting to happen. Now here he was, as much a victim as the miners. He received 1 final remote notification, the game notifying him that all of his assets had been seized and that he was no longer capable of gameplay. Sykes laughed silently, remembering when such things mattered. He righted a few of the overturned chairs, eyeing the dead miners. Eventually they'd have to stack the bodies against 1 wall. They'd also have to be careful not to become infected. He turned, looking at the wall behind him, then spied the other door. He'd forgotten about that. Perhaps it was a way out. According to his tunnel diagram, it opened into another section of the complex. If they were lucky, they could escape. He moved to the door, checked and found it unlocked. Then he cautiously pulled it open and saw Phillips. The Colonial Marine stood there. Had he hidden here when confronted with the miners in the room? Sykes was about to pull him out when he registered the blankness of the man's stare. Before Sykes could back away, Phillips reared back and spit. An immense orb of saliva hit the center of his faceplate and stayed there. Sykes took a few backward steps. Phillips followed him, spitting again and again. Sykes fired from the hip again, hitting Phillips in the stomach, the rounds blowing clean through. Phillips fell dead as Mykia and Haywald ran over. Then Sykes watched as the saliva began to move. Like a hyper amoeba, it grew appendages and pulled itself from the center of his mask to the sides, sliding under the faceplate and towards his face. Smaller sputum rivulated around the edges, seeking a way through the faceplate. Sykes dropped his rifle and struggled to remove his helmet. When he did, he hurled it across the room. Had any gotten on him? Was he infected? He vigorously wiped his face with his gloved hands, and the right hand came away with a small, wet stain. Was that it? Had he gotten it? Later, he didn't know how long later, because he must have blacked out, he found himself standing. He could just see them, Mykia and Haywald, standing on either side of him. He wondered if Chevalon was standing behind him. He moved to turn, but found he couldn't. He tried to lift his hand and discovered that was impossible. It was like it wasn't there, but he knew it was. But that part of the nervous system that governed non-autonomous muscle movements had been turned off.
It wasn't lost on him that he wouldn't be in this predicament and still be in command of 7 systems in Charity Rock if he had just done as Haywald had offered. Why had he done it? Why hadn't he stayed behind? Sykes had developed a finely honed sense of cowardice, and he should have followed it. Later, he wondered if his view might change. He was getting tired of staring at the closed door. He felt like a video game character waiting for the game to be turned on so he could do something. Anything. Even later, he began to laugh. Not out loud because he was incapable of it, but inside, in his mind, where he still felt normal. Uproariously, he laughed for days, especially when he repeated the phrase, "At least you'll die a hero," 100,000 times like it was punishment. Much later, he craved to spit and felt it pool in his mouth. Then, he didn't know how long it had been, he began to feel his body shutting down. Haywald and Mykia had long ago fallen. His legs were wobbly. He knew he was dying and welcomed it. No water, no food. It was only a matter of time. He tried to fall, if only to change his view, but still couldn't move anything non-autonomous. Damn it, he still wanted to spit. If only someone would open the damned door.
Dark Mother by David Farland. Sometimes we wake from dark dreams into a deeper darkness. Carter Burke pounded the lock mechanism on the door and felt a surge of relief as it bolted shut. Ripley, on the far side of the door, had had death in her eyes. Stupid sheep, he thought. She could have been rich. Yes, he'd tried to impregnate her and Newt with aliens, but he'd imagined that once they got to the bioweapons department at Weyland-Yutani, the creatures could have been safely removed, sort of like a C-section. They would have been fine, and they'd all have gotten rich. Instead, they were trapped beneath Hadley's hope, with xenomorphs filling the tunnels. Some people have no imagination. Stupid freaking cow. Now, to get out of this place. Burke whirled, fled through a storeroom, heard Ripley banging at the door, and glanced back. He drew a sliding panel shut between them and heard Chitin scrape the floor behind him. A hiss. Burke whirled to see a xenomorph warrior in the doorway, red warning lights reflecting off it. Terror spiked, sharp as a spear in the heart. He screamed, reached back to grab anything he might use as a weapon. The alien bared its double jaws, displaying rows of teeth dripping with white foam. But to Burke's shock, the creature did not bite. Instead, it grabbed him, slammed him painfully against the heavy metal door, knocking air from him and cracking the back of his skull. Everything went black. Air rushed past his face, under his arms. I'm flying. I'm Superman. He was a child again, flying through his house in his imagination. His parents' multi-million-dollar flat had glowing white walls set on a dim nightlight mode, with vast archways overhead, like a heavenly cathedral. No, he realized. I'm being carried. He felt strong hands gripping his ribs, holding him. An odd thought struck him. Think before you scream. Flying through the house was a vivid memory, one of his earliest. His mother had carried him to the bathroom. She'd pulled him from bed, still wet from urine. His mother dropped him roughly to the bathtub and turned on the water before he could begin to undress. Burke must have been about 4. He peered up into her beautiful face. Even as a young woman, his mother had a sculpted look. His father was a plastic surgeon, after all, and like the other surgeons at his country club, he'd made his wife stunning, inhumanly beautiful, a monument to his art. She changed her appearance from time to time, and on this occasion she appeared almost Latina, with a light coffee skin dye, black hair, and fiery black eye dye. Burke's father pushed his head through the bathroom door and warned, "Be gentle with him, hun."
"He stinks," his mother said. "God, children stink."
In this memory, Burke hardly recognized his mother. He remembered her better with bright blue eyes and golden hair, or as a redhead with wider cheeks. Like many women who had had too many surgeries, her face had lost its plasticity, had become curiously unanimated, more as if she'd been carved from marble than flesh. Her accusation of him stinking stung him. Burke was a bedwetter. No matter how much he bathed, his mother claimed he stank. As a smaller boy, he'd longed to hold her, had dreamt of cradling his head between her firm breasts, but he'd never been able to. She was a goddess, cool and untouchable. Burke trembled, felt pain in his sides, and realized that someone was still carrying him. "Think before you scream." He roused his sluggish eyes open enough to see. He was racing through a dim hall. The alien held him under the armpits, lurching and jostling at incredible speed as it raced down a long corridor. He struggled to breathe, took a mental inventory. He was in the grip of a xenomorph, taller than him and stronger than him. He knew where it was taking him. It carried him as his mother had, and with embarrassment, he felt a familiar warmth between his legs. He hadn't wet himself since he was a child, and the thought flashed, "The alien thinks I stink." He had no weapons. He'd been forced to flee Ripley and her Marines without one, but his father had taught him, "Your mind is your most powerful weapon." But his thoughts were muzzy right now and seemed to move at the speed of honey. Burke wondered if the creatures could understand human speech and spoke cautiously.
"Wait a minute," he offered. "Let's talk about this."
His heart pounded, and he waited for an interminable instant to see if the xenomorph would respond.
"Can you understand me? Are you open to negotiation?"
The xenomorph stopped running, threw him in the air a little, and turned Burke to face him.
"It understands me," he considered hopefully. "Or is it like a dog that just responds to tone?"
Without skipping a beat, the creature hissed and smashed him against a plasteel bulkhead, as if he were a baseball bat, and everything went dark. Burke woke to unbearable pain and sirens in a fetid room. He struggled to regain consciousness and found he could not move his arms or legs. He remembered where he was, what kind of creatures held him.
"Think before you scream."
He let himself go limp, playing dead. He could taste blood in his mouth and his right cheek felt swollen. He'd been dreaming. Terribly lucid dreams, like hallucinations caused by opium, where everything looked distorted but felt so real, as if the subconscious was struggling to communicate through vivid images. He tried to recall a fleeting image of a girl he'd seduced in college. In his dream, she'd said something like, "You're responsible for everything you put in your mouth." The message seemed terribly important. What was her name? Well, it didn't really matter. He'd seduced lots of girls. He was good-looking, after all, and rich, and girls would fall for any lie he told them. He opened his good eye and peered about in the dim light, bleary. He struggled to focus. Brownish-gray material covered the walls, looking for all the world like the interior of an animal's ribcage. He'd once killed a neighbor's dog as a child, and knew those shapes.
Other shapes seemed just as organic, but impossible to define. He recognized this place. The atmospheric processing plant, down in its lowest levels. The alien hive. His heart lurched, and he strained to move, but his torso, legs, and arms felt stuck in some resinous substance. Everything smelled hot, and the resin had an unidentifiable odor, similar to human vomit mixed with decay and sex. Around him, he saw the shadowy shapes of other people. Men, women, children. They stood encased in resin, frozen. Their faces twisted in horror, arms and fingers outstretched. He didn't recognize the closest man. He must have been a settler. There was a gaping hole in the man's chest where an alien spawn had burst out. That's where the rot is coming from. Human carcasses were everywhere, plastered one on top of another. Resin covered him, too, only his face was free. He could breathe the fetid air, but could not move. He experimented, tried swiveling his hips. The resin was thick around his legs like cement boots, but the resin felt more viscous next to his body. The outside material had hardened, like glue exposed to the air. He tried shaking his head, managed to force the resin back a bit, but could not break free. He experimented with his hands. The casing around his right hand was hard as stone, but on the left, it must have been fresher. It still felt viscous near his fingers. He fought and twisted till he managed to break the thin outer crust near his left hand. He imagined that if he worked fast enough, he might free an entire arm, then break open the rest of the crust inch by inch. He heard a splat, then looked up. By the light of a sputtering fire, he spotted movement through a partly obscured archway, saw the head and part of the body of an enormous xenomorph, one that stood at least 15 feet tall. It had a vast abdomen attached to it, tall as a house, longer than a bus, and she had just deposited an enormous white egg onto a pile of crap-like goo. Her abdomen rippled as muscles in it moved, like a piece of worm's gut, and then she lurched forward slightly. Burke recognized that body part, dredged a word from an old biology class. It was an ovipositor, like the ones on a carnivorous wasp or a queen termite. A smaller xenomorph came into view, picked up the egg on its little goo pile, and peered toward him. "Wait, no!" Burke shouted and tried to wiggle his hand. The huge alien mother made a soft growl, peered toward him. The smaller xenomorph set the egg aside, and Burke felt some relief. But the xenomorph drone hurried over to another egg, picked it up, and set it at Burke's feet. Burke felt scared witless. No plans would come. He tried to wriggle aside, to break his casing. He fought to free his hand, but the xenomorph hissed and lashed its bony tail, then thrust its teeth in his face. "Calm down," Burke said. "I get it. You don't want me to move." Yet he couldn't just sit there. The xenomorph backed away, watching him. Above its shoulders, dead men peered down, and Burke suddenly remembered a huge nativity scene that his mother had put up one Christmas. It had Mary and Joseph peering down at a baby Jesus in a cradle, while the wise men stared on and angels flew above. His mind twisted in dreamlike ways. Suddenly, Burke was Joseph, and the baby Jesus was an egg with one of those creatures, a face-hugger, inside. The hovering angels were horrid corpses, and once the egg hatched, the vaguely crab-like creature would climb to his face, insert a tube down his throat, implant some kind of embryo. "Look," he begged the xenomorph. The worker peered at him like an ignorant dog, but the queen in the other room turned her head, studying him.
Her face was rigid, chiseled and sculpted, and he saw his mother's calculating, unfeeling gaze behind those eyes. "What do you want?" he begged her. The room was hot. Fires were already blazing. This whole place was going to go up in a mushroom cloud, he knew. "I work for Weyland-Yutani Corporation. I can get you anything. What do you want? A new world?" He realized that he had to get creative, try to think on their level. "You want cows to eat? People? I can get them for you." The Queen Mother peered at him as if trying to decipher what he said, then turned away as she pooped another egg. Burke felt sweaty all over, had huge rivulets running down his face. He felt sick to his stomach and choked on vomit. The egg in front of him began to quiver and shake, and a crack appeared. His heart hammered wildly, and his mouth felt drier than he'd ever imagined, drier than the toxic sands of the Gobi. He struggled to break free, rocking wildly, and the xenomorph drone hissed a warning. He rocked and screamed until he could not move, and suddenly became aware that sometime in the past minute, he'd fallen back to sleep. His skull felt mushy and back. Concussion, he thought, as he fought to regain consciousness. He was locked in amber, peering down at the egg once again. Everything was off. The facehugger had been coming for him, but now it seemed to still be in the egg. He realized that he had been dreaming, yet the drone xenomorph was still watching him. "Screw you," he shouted as a facehugger oozed from its shell, a beige nightmare. The xenomorph drone hissed encouragement to the facehugger, then peered up in satisfaction, like a midwife caught in the throes of admiring the miracle of birth. "Screw all of you," Burke shouted. "That ain't no baby Jesus, and I ain't no loser." He raged and struggled for one more moment. "Think before you scream." There's still a way to turn this around, he realized. He'd hoped to smuggle one of these facehuggers off-planet inside Ripley and Newt. An insane thought took him, so crazy that he realized it was genius. This creature could be a gold mine. If I carry it inside me, and if I can get on the ship, put myself in stasis, and leave instructions for those who find me, it will still work, he realized. All he lacked was time. The whole processing plant was going to blow soon. He'd need to break free after the attack, get out before the creature ate him from inside. All too soon, the facehugger leapt at him. It seemed to float in a dreamlike motion, its legs waving at him and then grasping his head. It covered his face with its soft, crab-like body and tried to insert something down his throat. Burke struggled to keep his teeth clenched, to twist his face aside, but realized that every second he fought was another second wasted. "Swallow it down," he told himself. "Just take it." He had to do it, even though he was screaming inside. He opened his mouth wide and let the facehugger do its work. "Oh, God, what have I done?" But it was his only chance. He didn't have a gun, nothing to even the odds. He didn't have the strength to break free. He couldn't breathe. He fought the creature for a breath, but couldn't get air. His face and muscles all strained and began to burn as if he were drowning. "Just take it," he told himself. And as he faded from consciousness, he remembered. As a teen, he'd walked in on his mother once, the famous realtor, as she entertained a client. What the man did to her looked more like rape than lovemaking. Burke had kept the incident secret for 3 days, worried what would happen. Would his father be furious? Had his mother seduced the man or been raped?
Would she leave his father? Part of him hoped that she'd leave. She'd run the house with an iron hand, a cruel mistress. Part of him just wanted to be free of the secret. And so, at a Sunday dinner, he told his father what he'd seen, hoping that Mom would confess, that maybe she'd be freed by it, that maybe things would work out better. Heavy silence followed. Burke's father, a stern man who seemed never to grow old, simply spread his hands above his plate, winked at his wife, and said, "We all do what we must in this family." "What do you mean?" Burke asked, lips trembling. "Your mother brings in a lot of money," his father said. "I'm a famous surgeon, but I only supply 18% of our income. Your mother gets the rest." His mother was in her redhead phase, with wide-set cheekbones and skin bleached to ivory. "Don't you understand, son?" she said. "I wear different faces for my clients. I find out what they like, then target them. They wouldn't pay a normal realtor much, but a beautiful woman, one who could sue them into oblivion, who could expose them for what they are, lead them to arrest or divorce, they pay me very well." While Burke's jaw dropped, his father smiled. "I saw the rape. It was recorded. I've seen all of them. Why do you think I put these different faces on for your mother? It's for her marks." Burke's mother studied him with her sculpted gaze and said, "I do what I must for money. And if you are any son of mine, you will do your part, too." Burke had always done what he felt he needed to in order to get ahead. He woke to blaring sirens with a throat that felt hot and raw. The room had grown blistering. Fires were raging. Sweat poured from him. Too much sweat. It was in his clothes, encasing him beneath the cocoon. He felt wrung out at the end of his strength. He looked about for the facehugger, realized that it wasn't around. A dream, he realized. Must have been a bad dream. Through the narrow corridors, he could no longer see the xenomorph worker nor the queen. The egg was still in front of him, waiting to hatch. Sirens blared. A female computerized voice warned, "Attention! Emergency! All personnel must evacuate immediately. You now have 15 minutes to reach minimum safe distance." Shit, Burke wondered. How long was I out for? 15 minutes. Did he have time to escape? Even if he ran as fast as he could, he wouldn't make it outside the blast zone. He needed a vehicle. Even a wheeled excursion vehicle might do. A ship would be best. He thrust his left arm against the resin, banging it with the heel of his palm. The outer crust cracked reluctantly, and he managed to reach around. By punching the crust above his right hand, he damaged the resin, but he felt weak. The material around his legs and torso had hardened while he slept, locking his body into place. Worst of all, he had a stomachache. While he wondered at it, his thoughts grew muzzy. He realized that it was not the normal pain of bloating or heartburn, but something he'd never imagined. He felt a creature inside him, down in his guts, like a huge octopus in a bowl swimming about. Terror lanced through him, cold and shocking, so that he felt nearly mindless with fear. He knew what was coming. Somehow he'd been impregnated by a facehugger, but when? He flailed against the resin until his left fist became bloody, pulpy and raw. He still could not break through. He pummeled until his head dropped in fatigue. A rest. He tried to catch his breath. He woke again. Sirens continued to blare, and the computer warned that Burke had 13 minutes to reach safety. In the distance, xenomorphs shrieked in pain and rage. The hissing of a flamethrower sounded nearby. Someone was fighting. The Marines? For an instant, Burke imagined himself being a hero. With a sudden burst of energy, he broke from his resinous casing, staggered into a hallway, and saw the queen alien rushing toward him. He stared into dark eyes that seemed not to reflect the firelight so much as drink it in. His mother's eyes. His mother's chiseled, emotionless face, with skin thinly stretched over a skull. The alien morphed into his mother. She said in an echoing voice, "You're free." He realized that he could make it to the ship. He had to. So he began to jog, his path lit by a trail of flares that burned among the twists and turns of the hive. Something wrenched inside him, and he felt terribly hungry. The chest burster was draining his energy, depleting it. Burke ran for a bit, reached an elevator. He hit the call button, but no elevator dropped. Instead, the sirens blared. 7 minutes to reach minimum safe distance. He struggled to catch his breath and realized at last that the lift wasn't coming. Fire vented up from a nearby crevice and lightning arced between two pillars. Some metal beams fell nearby and the station shuddered. The plant was coming apart. Burke hurried to the emergency stairs and began to climb. The building shook and more flames shot up beside the open staircase. He reached the top of the landing platform as the mechanized voice called, 2 minutes to reach minimum safe distance. Burke gazed up to see the blunt shape of the space shuttle lifting off into clouds, the fires of its engines gleaming bright in the half-light. Flames shot up around the platform, impossibly hot, and lightning arced into the sky in a bright crown. The whole platform trembled as if it would teeter and fall into the fiery pit. Burke reached to his aching head, mussed his hair, and peered about in frustration. Something moved inside him, pushing out his ribs, like a baby on steroids, kicking. Fires vented from a dozen shafts nearby, billowing soot and smoke. The last of his hopes flew away with the shuttle. 1 minute to reach minimum safe distance, the computer announced, and something within him lurched. Burke shook his head, wondering, is there life after death? Do I get another chance? Or am I just going straight to hell? He wondered how many billions of people had asked that question in their final moment. He dropped to his knees, too weary to flee anymore, and gave birth. The alien ripped from his chest. Blood and fluids gushed out with it, his guts and stomach spilling onto the metal floor like afterbirth. Miraculously, the creature seemed to have missed ripping out his heart and lungs. It just left a gaping hole and lay there, its skin looking almost red in the firelight. It made a tiny growl and peered around. Burke slumped to his side. Felt his heart weakening, the blood and life pouring out. His breathing slowed until he had no more energy. He blinked and found himself waking to see a facehugger still crawling toward him. The ground shook and he realized, this place is going to blow. Sometimes we can wake from dark dreams into a deeper darkness.
Episode 22 by Larry Coria. Saga of the Weapon, Season 1, Episode 22. The M41A Pulse Rifle. The M41A is one of the most successful combat rifles in history, and has become a potent symbol of American military might. not just on Earth, but into the furthest reaches of space. It has seen battle on every continent and dozens of worlds. It is beloved by those who use it, and feared by